Hello and welcome to Euactiv's Agri-Food Podcast. I'm Natasha Foote.
And I am Gerardo Fortuna.
And here's your weekly update on all things agriculture and food in the EU from Euactiv's Agri-Food News team.
Welcome to another episode of the Agri-Food Podcast. This week, we're going to talk about both the agri and the food part, but we're going to start with the latter.
The food part.
We actually start with the latter.
Oh, stop.
This wasn't prepared. Eh?
This is just the beginning. This is just the beginning. I mean,
puns will pop up in our head and power out of all the time. Our listeners maybe are not aware that it's 9 a.m. as we speak. So we just had breakfast. What did you have for breakfast, Natasha?
I had some porridge. It's a very British breakfast, you know, solid porridge.
Are you sure?
I'm pretty sure. Yeah. Why? Should I be scared?
I think you rather had some slices of bread and you spread butter on them. Can you confirm that?
I see. Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I mean, that I am guilty of enjoying toast and butter regularly. I am British after all. Butter, staple part of our diet.
That's what I had too.
Okay, and yeah, so I had toast and butter. Yeah, okay. Yeah. There you go. Now you can go into your...
Why are we talking about butter today? Because there's a food scandal, a Buttergate in Canada.
What a good gate. Yeah. That sounds excellent. Buttergate.
Yeah, indeed. You probably heard of that.
It sounds utterly ridiculous.
And it's becoming quite big overseas, although it's not clear if it's just media hype or there are some scientific ground. Mm-hmm. So it all started with consumers, actually. So Canadian foodies have realized that over the past few months, the butter was harder to spread than usual. There was this Canadian cookbook author, Julie Van Rosendaal, who basically asked on Twitter if others have also noticed that butter was no longer soft at room temperature. So consumers and journalists have started digging into the matter. And what they found out, Natasha?
What they found out? Well, it's quite an interesting story, actually. So there's different theories going around and it's not totally certain what exactly is going on. But the kind of the dominant theory, the one that everyone's talking about a lot, is this idea that basically cows were supplemented with more palm kernel extract, so from palm oil. And this is a practice that, you know, I think producers have been doing for decades. It's not a new practice. But what we've seen happen is, and what the theory goes, is that the coronavirus pandemic has seen the sales of butter go through the roof, you know, with everyone baking, everyone at home, there's nothing else to do, which is nice, actually, that everyone's kind of getting in touch with our food and baking again. But this has, you know, put some pressure on the supply chain. And the idea is that maybe farmers were actually supplementing with more palm oil because this is a really energy dense food, you know, so it helps produce a lot more milk. It helps sustain the cows. Now, the issue is that this palm oil is, you know, it's the melting point of it's quite high. So if you think of other things that palm oil's in, I don't know, your favorite, Gerardo, Nutella. You're a Nutella fan, no?
I will not deny that I picture all this thing like cows eating Nutella.
Cows eating. Yeah, that's exactly it. Actually, why am I explaining it? That's totally what happened. But yeah, this is interesting. I mean, obviously, aside from the fact that, you know, maybe this is making, it's changing the consistency of our beloved butter, which is quite a scandal, to be honest. You know, don't touch my butter. But also, obviously, palm oil carries all these other implications. You know, it's linked with heavy deforestation and environmental issues. You know, it's seen widely as a kind of environmental disaster in many places, and also is linked with human rights issues. So it's also got this kind of social environmental component as well. And, you know, it's quite an interesting story, I think, of people connecting so much more with their food and trying to understand, you know, where it's coming from and noticing these details. I think it's quite interesting. But yeah, I guess people didn't really even know that this is what was going into their food, which, or going into their butter, going into their dairy.
And we've also done some research, I mean, to see if this alleged scandal could also affect Europe and whether there are some implications related to dairy imports from Canada to the EU. Actually, we found out, I mean, a source we contacted told us that, for instance, in France, it's legal to feed cattle with palm oil. I mean, it's on the Livestock Farming Institute website, too. And we contacted, again, several sources, Eurostat, too. Eurostat is the statistical office of the European Union. We got some figures about the import of butter from Canada. Dairy products export from Canada have risen quite a lot after the CETA, which is the free trade agreement between the EU and Canada. Like, for instance, imported cheese went from 3 tons in 2018 to 106 tons in 2019, but there's not like a huge number for butter from Canada in the EU. Actually, it's almost none. It's, I mean, we import basically nothing from Canada. We also contacted some sources in the European dairy supply chain, producers, traders, and they all confirmed that there are no implications related to dairy imports from Canada. Also because, again, we import basically nothing from Canada. It's also true that in Canada, there's also a quite complicated subsidy regime that make Canada not a competitive supplier of dairy products. The subsidy scheme is the Milk Class 7 that allows Canada to export powder below the cost of production, but there is no import demand for these products in Europe. So we import nothing. At the same time, Canada is an important export market for the EU, especially for cheese. And this has been granted because of the improved market access in the form of a zero DT quota under the CETA. We basically read that this Buttergate could lead to a shortage of dairy products. I mean, it is expected, some expect some kind of shortage of dairy products. So we basically ask milk producers and butter traders, dairy products traders, if they consider this as a good opportunity for EU exporters too, but they don't see a real shortage of dairy products on the horizon in Canada. Again, it's not something that Europeans could take advantage of in the next months, but still, as Natasha said, it's quite an interesting story, because again, it started from consumers.
I think that's actually a really interesting part of this whole tale, you know, this kind of noticing this detail and everyone getting much more in touch with their food and where it's coming from and asking how it's being produced and what effect this has. I think that's kind of definitely an interesting element of this story.
Also because they're the first that they could experience a change, for instance, in production practices or a change in the standards of the production of a certain food products.
It also shows how much consumers care about what's going into their food and, you know, and the importance of having this kind of regulation and transparency and everything in the industry. So it clearly shows there's a small margarine of error in these food supplements.
Actually, there's another interesting news this week. This was quite European because the Portugal Agriculture Minister, Maria do Seo Antunes, sorry, Portuguese listeners, for my pronunciation.
Absolutely butchered that pronunciation. I would never do that.
Yeah, but I mean, my mother tongue is from the Neo-Latin group, so it's at least it's a bit similar. So she will convene a joint negotiation meeting with all the three rapporteurs in the European Parliament to seek a breakthrough in the Common Agricultural Policy talks. She called it Super Trilogue.
Dun, dun, dun. Wow, that sounds exciting.
These kind of negotiations, I mean, are incredible, because we started with the five column, and now we're having a super trilogue. So it's really pioneeristic, I would say. And they also started publishing the four column. The four column is the...
They did, yeah. It's quite an interesting move, actually, you know, in the interest of transparency, and interesting to see.
I have to say that the reaction to this super trilogue weren't really enthusiastic.
Oh, yeah?
I mean, while we're talking about super trilogue, I mean, you know that the Common Agricultural Policy is made of three main dossiers. There's one on Common Market Organization with the rapporteur Eric Andrieu. There's one on strategic plan. There's one on horizontal organization, strategic plan with Peter Jahr, and horizontal governance with Ulrike Müller. So the European Parliament has three negotiators. The negotiator for the ministers, for the European ministers, the council, is basically the rotating presidency. So Portuguese minister and her team are negotiating on each file. So in order to find an agreement, or at least improving the chances to get a final agreement by May, they want to do, instead of separated negotiations, they want to do like a joint one with all the three negotiators of the European Parliament. It's quite interesting because, I mean, there are some plans proposed by the Commission. I remember there was the clean energy package that was made of, if I remember correctly, six or seven regulation or directives. And again, they had different negotiations too, with different rapporteurs. And sometimes you have this feeling that you're a bit lost, particularly not only if you're a reporter, even if you are a negotiator, because when they are so interlinked, you need to know what's happening on another table, no? Mm-hmm. And it's the same with CAP, no? I remember that when there was the omnibus regulation, which is basically the update of the past CAP program, there was just one rapporteur, the MEP Paolo De Castro. So it's not a bad idea. Also because, I mean, it's true that they have three different negotiators, but in the end, it's the same institution. No, they represent the same institution, and they have a clear mandate. So let's see what happened on this front. As the minister, the Portuguese minister, said, March is the month for expecting some kind of breakthrough. And because now, I mean, you know, with social conditionality that Natasha is actually covering quite extensively, there are some outstanding issues, no?
Definitely.
So, you know, time is ticking, again, in terms of implementing the amount of delegated directive regulation that will come with the reform of the CAP, the lawmakers need to speed up a bit the procedure.
It's definitely quite a daunting task to piece all this together. As you said, there are so many outstanding issues. It's going to be interesting to see how they manage to pull this together by the end of March. But exciting big CAP party, everyone's invited. And I think, you know, there's many kind of sticking points here. There's many things that are left to be hashed out in these negotiations, but there are two major issues that I think we see as being, you know, these major kind of impasses, not really sure how they're going to move past this. But one is one that's being discussed for a very long time, and it's about this definition of what actually constitutes an active farmer, and what, you know, because the definition of what a farmer is and what it isn't, you know, really delineates a lot of things. It lays the basis for how subsidy program works, who gets what, and also, you know, this issue about small farmers, and how they can, you know, is there a definition for a small farmer, how they can be helped and aided by the CAP. And then there's this other major issue, which is social conditionality. So this is something that if you follow our podcast, something we've touched upon many times in the last couple of weeks, because it's a relatively, or an issue that's come to the fore relatively recently. There's definitely a strong divide. So social conditionality is basically this idea of tying cap subsidies to social elements of the farming sector. So that means workers' rights, making sure that basically farmers can only get paid subsidies if they're upholding a certain standard of workers' rights. And this, you know, we already have environmental conditionality in the cap, but this is now another form of conditionality. So we have the Parliament that's really backed this and are really pushing for this. And then we have the Council, who are kind of much more reluctant, saying this is outside the remit of the cap. And, you know, they've put forward different proposals for including it, some stronger, some weaker. But, you know, there doesn't seem to be a clear path for how social conditionality will play out and how this will work out for these negotiations. So it will be interesting to see kind of what comes from this super trilogue in terms of these main sticking points. And if they can move on these points, then I think there will be some more movement on the cap trying to get things going. So it will definitely be interesting to see what happens there.
You also mentioned basically all the outstanding issues in the strategic plant and horizontal regulation. But at the same time, there are like a lot of outstanding issues in the CMO, in the Common Market Organization. Unsurprisingly, because again, Common Market Organization is quite big. It's basically regulating all the food stuff marketed in the European Union. For instance, it's the veggie burger. The veggie burger row is in the Common Market Organization. Just for mechanics, the most pop reference on the Common Agricultural Policy. But some compromises have been found so far. We've seen something, and we reported on this in our newsletter, on wine, particularly on the implanting rights. But there's still something open on wine again, particularly the vine variety, the ones that come from outside the EU, like the American variety. But there's also a big issue of the market intervention in times of crisis. It's something that we're actually experiencing right now. And there's this crisis fund that was considered by the Commission, and it's still a bone of contention between the European Parliament and the Council, the EU ministers, because European Parliament wouldn't like to split. I mean, they don't want that the crisis reserve is linked to cap payment, in the sense that using money from this fund won't affect the amount of total subsidies that goes to farmers, because it's something like they anticipate, like it is right now, they basically anticipating payments that would have been gone anyway to farmers. So it's the European Parliament wants to decouple this fund from direct payments, so creating a real reserve fund independent from the amount of money dedicated to farmer subsidies, while the European Council isn't that on the same page on this. So let's see what happens. I mean, again, it's a long way to May, where both the Commissioner, European Commissioner Janusz Wojciechowski, and the negotiators aim at reaching an agreement.
So that's all from us this week. And this week, like every week, the Agri-Food Podcast was produced by Euractiv's Agri-Food News Team, Gerardo Fortuna and Natasha Foote, with the help of Euractiv's podcast producer, Evie Chiori. You can also find this podcast on all major streaming platforms, including Amazon, Apple, Spotify, and Stitcher.
And don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter so you don't miss the latest agricultural news from the EU. I'm Gerardo Fortuna. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.